Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Welcome to another, sorry, Mike's on codeine. Wackos, welcome to another episode of Without a Country. I'm Corinne Fisher. Man, if that song, it doesn't get you amped the fuck up, I don't know what I can do for you. Nine Inch Nails, I'm going to go home and blast it. Hello, I'm fresh back from D.C. Your girl was on C-SPAN. I'm a pundit now. I texted my mom, I said, your little girl's a pundit. I don't know what to tell everybody. I'm full on. My plan of just pursuing politics, even though I don't really know anything about it, is working like a motherfucking charm. Shout out to Wacko and Fucker Leslie for facilitating my appearance on C-SPAN. It was her idea. It wasn't even mine. They emailed me and I said, Leslie, that's a great idea. I would love to do that. And it was a jolly good time, and we'll get into that for in just a second, because I have clips, and they are wild. Thanks to everyone who came out to the D.C. Comedy Loft in Washington, D.C. Some of those shows were absolutely wild. One of the shows was, like, one of my favorite shows I've ever done at the on the road. A very interesting experience, and that was our last stop before the official Eye of the Tiger tour starts that I just announced today. So excited. It'll be me and Chloe LaBranch. And here are the dates. Tampa, Florida, April 17th. Miami, Florida, April 18th. Atlanta, April 19th and 20th. Columbus, Ohio, April 25th. Raleigh, North Carolina, April 30th. Philly, May 1st. Boston, May 2nd. Portland, Oregon, May 14th. San Francisco, May 15th. Sacramento, California, May 16th. Seattle, May 17th. Houston, June 27th. Austin, June 28th and 29th, and Salt Lake City, Utah, September 26th. Most of those are just big one-off shows because that's what I requested, because I'm going to be able to get to a lot more cities if I only do one night there. It is spending these long weekends in places that makes me not want to go on tour when we could just fill up one room and then mommy can go home. But a couple of those, I know like Seattle has multiple shows. Austin, that has a bunch of shows just because there's a big fan base there. But yeah, get those tickets immediately. And we are going to have such a fun, crazy time. I'm so happy with how the new material is coming along and developing. And like, it's a great show. Like, I pay out of my own pocket to bring my own feature because it ups the show so much. You know, you're with the feature for 20, 25 minutes out of the show. That's a big portion of the show. And when you bring your own feature, you're really controlling the quality of the show a lot more. And I want you guys, especially since a lot of you like aren't huge stand-up comedy fans, maybe like Guys Be Fucked or Me or Christina was one of your first stand-up comedy shows. I want you to love stand-up. It's not just, a, you know, it's, listen, we love I love a show just about me. I was just watching the intro again, really thinking in my head how disturbing it is, how much I enjoy watching a montage of photos of myself. Listen, no one loves me more than me, but I want you, I don't really care if you love me or not, I want you to love stand-up comedy. That's what I want you to love. It has brought so much joy to my life, and I want to share that joy with you guys so that you continue seeing live comedy after you see my show, whether you like my show or not. I think my show is good. I think I put on a good show. I think Chloe's excellent. We always try to get a really good host in there as well. But yeah, come buy a ticket. And a lot of people in DC did this because I requested it. But please, you know, it's great to go see art alone. And I totally condone that. If you need to unite, go see the show alone. Or certainly come go with other fuckers or wackos or Corinne heads. But if you know someone who you think would like my comedy, maybe they have a dark sense of humor, they're kind of sassy, they're from New Jersey, whatever the case may be, and maybe they just don't have time to listen to a podcast or not interested. Maybe you recommend one of my podcasts and they haven't got to it. I get that. Bring one of those friends along. So many people in DC brought a friend who was not familiar with me or had heard of me but had never seen my work. And that is how we grow, especially as female comedians. I know I kind of talk about this concept a lot, but I talk about it because it's important and it directly affects my career and the career of other women in my field. People don't cold see female comedians. It's a huge problem. So unfortunately, that burden then falls on you guys and on me. And I appreciate anyone who has brought someone who previously did not know me to my show and has made them a Corinne head. And we're going to keep saying that. Yeah, there's going to be exclusive tour merch at the Eye of the Tiger tour. It's just going to be so fucking fun. And Chloe and I, we're so ridiculous together. And we had a really good time in DC, and it made me extra excited for the Eye of the Tiger tour, which was inspired, you know, the title was inspired by Chloe making fun of me because I one time told her, and this is was my mistake. I one time told her that before shows, I put on a hoodie and I put headphones in. And I would walk up and down the streets of New York City listening to Eye of the Tiger to get myself amped up. And this was like mostly for improv shows before I was even a stand-up comedian, which makes the anecdote that much more embarrassing. But I told her that in confidence, and she has not let me live it down since. So now we're embracing it. We're leaning in. I'm going to feel the thrill of the Eye of the Tiger, and I want to extend the Eye of the Tiger to every one of you in my audience. You know, listen to Eye of the Tiger. Pursue your dreams and your passions in whatever field they may be. So thank you so much. And moving on, today's enemy of the state, also inspired by this weekend, Amtrak conductors. This is my enemy of the state this week.
Enemy of the state.
All right. So when you go to DC, there's a lot of traffic. So we decided to take Amtrak, specifically Acela, because it's 3 hours flat. Great idea. I mean, it made that trip to DC so much more tolerable. Expensive as fuck. I even looked into flying. The tickets were like over $300 a piece to go on Acela. But I was like, should we just fly? And then that was still a little more expensive. So I was like, okay, we'll take the train. I don't mind the train. But, you know, for these closer ones, I like to bring Alfred with me whenever I can. I love my boy. I love spending time with him. He loves sniffing new cities. And I thought DC would be a fun time for him. And so I brought him along. You know, he's in carrier, as he is supposed to be. He's, you know, about 17-pound dog. But every time I've brought Alfred on Amtrak, and this has been a couple times, it's one of those places where they allow pets. And I put it in quotes because it's like, yeah, they're not going to kick you off if you have a pet, but they still treat you and your animal like absolute shit. And I'm just really, really tired of it. Like, it's 2024. Millennials have made it very clear that our pets are our children. And this kind of behavior is unacceptable. If you are a place, and this goes for hotels too, I have this problem all the time with travel. Like, if you allow animals at your establishment, especially when you're charging more, as Amtrak does, like Alfred had a ticket, okay? It's $39 each way. It's not free. And the joke is, similar to if you have them on a plane, you're paying extra for the pet, but it's not like you're getting additional space. So it's like, what exactly am I paying for? Because he's in a carrier as if he was my luggage. you know, so he's not taking up, it's not like I get additional room, especially on a flight. But on Amtrak, they say they have to go like in front of your seat by your feet. So I go, I don't know where my feet are going. Am I supposed to put them on my fucking dog? Like, number one. And I'm tiny. I'm 5'3.5". I'm a 6.5-foot shoe. What if you're a grown man? Like, what are you doing? It's just like they love to treat animals like props, and it's really quite disgusting. I've never had an Amtrak conductor be anything but nasty about me having an animal on board, even though I'm doing all the things. And so you don't get to choose your seats. The seat was just given to you when you buy the Acela ticket. So Chloe and I were in one of these four-seaters where it's the table in the middle and then two other strangers are on the other side, right? So it's me and an adult man. We have our feet underneath the table. And I'm like, there's no room, literally, unless I put my feet on my dog, to put Alfred under there. So I had him in the carrier, literally on my lap. It also allows him to not get scared from the noises underneath, and so he can get a little sunlight, look out the window. But again, completely in the zipped carrier, and he was on my own lap, not taking up any other seats, any other spaces. And it does say clearly on the instructions that the animal has to be by your feet, but it's also like, that's fine if you're not placed in the four-seater, but we were placed in the four-seater. And the person next to me was Chloe, so it was my companion traveler. I wasn't bothering a companion traveler that didn't have to, you know, do with me, not someone who's allergic to dogs or anything like that. Anyway, but they're just like, not only they're like, you have to go on the, you know, on the floor, but they're just so fucking nasty about it. I'm just so fucking sick of anyone with a tiny bit of power trying to wield it. Like, I'm sorry that whatever you wanted to do didn't work out. And it's also ridiculous because like being an Amtrak conductor is a totally cool job. Like, it's like the outfit's cool. It seems like a nice work environment, quite frankly. Like, what the fuck is all of your problems? Like, every single person, and I travel so much, right? They're just fucking so nasty. And I'm like a rule follower as far as those things are concerned. Like, not societally, but like as far as like what I'm supposed to do on an airplane. I was raised as a rule follower, and I am a rule follower. I read the instructions. I follow them. I show up with my signed paperwork. I do all the fucking shit. So like, stop being such cunts, okay? Stop. Every single one of you are fucking cunts, and I don't know what a dog did to you in your past life, but go and heal it, because it's aggressive. All right, got that off my chest. That has been irking me for fucking years, and like, Alfred doesn't deserve that. Again, like, we're just, it's like, it's almost hack at this point. Like, it's, you know, when we talk about, like, you know, as liberal elites being on the wrong side of history, this is what, if you're treating animals like a fucking prop or like a piece of luggage in 2024, you're on the wrong side of history. I got to be honest, okay? That animals are equal to us. Sorry to break the news to you. And if we don't start treating them like that ASAP, it's going full Planet of the Apes, and I can't wait. I'm going to be laughing maniacally as an ape tears my heart from my chest because I'm taking one for the team because I'm on the animal side. Hey there, responsible adults over the age of 21 living in states where Delta 8 is legal. Do you want to get high? Do you want to get really high? Do you want to get really super duper fucking high? Well, then now is the time to go to yodelta.com where you can stock up on high quality, lab tested Delta 8. You know, this is a longtime sponsor of Without a Country. You know, their stuff works, right? Because they keep buying ads, which means people keep buying product, and the product keeps working, so people keep buying more. That's just common sense, people, okay? Mike, you're scrolling up too much. So if you're over the age of 21 and living in the majority of states where this is legal, you're going to go to yodelta.com and stock up on Delta 8. What's Delta 8? Again, jury's out, but it's found in hemp and can be legally shipped to various states, and it gets you high. At yodelta.com, you can find a mix of gummies and vapes for all your getting stoned needs. I can tell you that Delta 8 works and that these products, of course, should be taken responsibly, as any product should, as anything in life should. Be responsible, okay? So once more, that's yodelta.com, the official Delta 8 sponsor of the GAS Digital Network. And if you use promo code GAS, G-A-S, you're going to get 25% off. Once more, that's promo code GAS, G-A-S, for 25% off. YoDelta, home of the Delta 8 that will get you super high. Now, back to our show. All right. Moving on to other fucking insane people in the world, this C-SPAN segment. So, okay, so this was Saturday morning, 9:15 a.m. to 10 a.m., 45 minutes of unfiltered C-SPAN comment airtime. I was on C-SPAN, showed up at the studio in Washington, D.C., and I really asked them ahead of time to give me some topics that we were talking about, but they basically just said, like, we're going to talk about your podcast. And then I learned you know, maybe the day before, that I was going to be taking live callers on the air. And I'm like, what? Like, what could I possibly, unless they need advice in their relationship, I don't know what kinds of conversations I could possibly be having. And man, was it an enlightening experience. Like, it is comical, but I also think on the flip side, I think this is an important insight onto who is politically involved in this country and the kinds of thoughts that our fellow voters, our fellow reproducers, our fellow drivers, people that we break bread with in this country, how uninformed they are, how biased they are, a lot of hate in their hearts. I mean, it was a real wake-up call. It was a real wake-up call. And so I have selected two of my favorite calls from this segment on C-SPAN. It was the show is Washington Post. So the first call that I want to share with you guys is a caller named Jim, and he is still upset about the Barbie movie. Reminder, it is March 2024. So, Mike, can you play that for me?
Okay. Jim is in Boca Raton, Florida, on our Republican line. Go ahead, Jim.
Yes, good morning, Corrine. I would say, full disclosure, I am a 70-year-old white Protestant Christian male.
Okay.
So she self-identified during the interview as a liberal or left of center.
Liberal gone rogue.
Thank you. Kimberly's listening.
So let's dig down on that a little bit. I'd like your perspective on feminism specifically. Are you familiar with Bill Maher? If you are, you watch his show.
I've met Bill Maher. I've been on his show, and we got into a fight, and they didn't air it. If you want to know some behind the scenes, I've been to Bill Maher's underground bar.
Yes. Well, I watched that on the internet as well. So let's go down on feminism a bit. Bill Maher pointed out a couple weeks ago on the show that he had gone to watch the film Barbie. And the Barbie, which I will not watch, I have no interest in it whatsoever, but be that as it may.
Hard
it's
stance.
It's a feminist diatribe, as I can understand it. And they rail against the male-dominated culture. And then he goes home and he checks the board of directors of Mattel, the company that produces Barbie as a toy. And
thanks for clarifying that.
Turns out that over 50% of their board is female.
What is the question that you have, Jim, exactly?
Kimberly for the win.
How does feminism today contend that men are running and rule the society, white males specifically, heterosexual white males like myself? And also, can she define for me toxic masculinity?
Okay, so those are two distinct things that we can get your perspective
sure.
on modern feminism and what toxic masculinity is.
Right. You know, I think it's not, you know, he expressed that modern feminism is the stance that men are ruining society. And that's absolutely not true. That's not the feminist perspective. To me, the feminist perspective is that more so I would explain it as men have a bit of a chokehold on society. And those are two very different concepts. Like, there's absolutely no arguing that if you are born specifically straight, white, and male, that you just have an easier start. That doesn't mean that men don't go through challenges. There certainly need to be more in touch with their emotions. I think that would be great. And toxic masculinity is just kind of, to me, it's like not listening to women. You even see it in comedy a lot. Like, men are just unwilling to even go and see a female comedian. I'm like a very successful comedian, and you go out into my showroom and it is 90% women. And if you go to see an unknown male comedian, it will be a lot more diverse audiences because female partners are so willing to check out the interests of their male partners. And men are just unwilling to do that. So, I mean, that's a piece of it. Toxic masculinity, though, I mean, that's a pretty large concept that we could talk about for a long time. I don't know that we're going to get it in a blip on C-SPAN.
Probably not.
Yeah.
Jimbo in Bakersfield.
Okay, that was clip one. My favorite part of it was everyone kind of called in with a verbal manifesto, not really a question for me. Like, they took it as everyone has their, you know, 30 seconds on a soapbox. And so what to me this says, and we already knew this, we've already known this on the show, is we are desperate as a society, and I think this is human nature, to be heard. So people, when there's a call-in show, they're not really, I don't think they're really looking to make change. I don't think they're really looking to have a conversation. I think they need a little time in their day when someone just listens to this, you know, theory that they think they developed. Does he think he's the first person to describe the Barbie movie as a feminist diatribe? Yeah, no, you're not. I don't even like where did you Google Barbie bad and then that's what you you got? It's just it's hack material. And it's, I don't know. I was just like, what are we even talking about here? Again, it's people really honing in on these things that aren't important. I don't think I'm an artist, and it's like, I don't think out of all the things going on in the world, the Barbie movie is the thing that was most important, that you should be waking up first thing Saturday morning calling C-SPAN about. We have real challenges. People are fucking dying. And you're calling about the Barbie movie because you're still upset about it. And then to take it a step further, you're that upset about it that you called C-SPAN at 9 a.m. on a Saturday, yet you haven't even seen it. That's the real issue. We're all so angry about things that we haven't even experienced. How can you be that angry about something you didn't even watch? You listen to someone who you already agree with, in this case Bill Maher, talk about it, and you just said, I'm gonna use his opinion. I think a lot of people do that. A lot of times you'll be like, did you actually read that thing? Did you actually watch that comedy special? Did you actually watch that film? Did you actually hear that person talk? No. Well, then you shouldn't have a fucking opinion on them. I'm going to take a break and for a second and read some. God, there was such funny comments. So like over 105 people commented on Twitter on my appearance. And I looked at other tweets from C-SPAN and they did not get this much traction. So I'm really patting myself on the back because, you know, any press is good press. A lot of it is trashing me and I absolutely don't care. So they tweeted, we are joined by writer and comedian Corinne Fisher to discuss her podcast Without a Country and political news of the day. One reply says she was a breath of fresh air. And then this woman with gray hair, Lola Thomas, she looks to be about, I don't know, 70 years old. She replies to she was a breath of air with all caps, not. Sick burn, Lola. You fucking did it to me. You did it to me. Another person, Deb Johnson, a lot of pick me girls, and I use girl lightly, a lot of pick me ladies on this thread. Comedian or chameleon? Never would have recognized her between the two picks. In one, I had black hair, and then in the video, I had blonde hair. It's still quite clearly me. I even have the same fucking makeup on because I'm doing my red lip, dark eye. It goes this emoji with the teeth like this. It goes, she's safe from conservative news as labeling her right wing. Should she decide to leave the dark side, might I suggest ditching the gravel voice? Again, it's like, so we're going to pick apart the way that I speak, the actual tonality of my voice. Do you want to have a conversation or don't you? Are you interested in having a conversation or are you not? Are you just interested in playing this childlike game of name calling? Like, because I would really like to have a conversation. I'm interested in having a conversation. I want to make change. Derek goes, Americans are currently getting critical thinking and media literacy tips from a comedian, and we wonder why we're stuck with a two-party duopoly. Derek wasn't listening to the interview. I already called myself out for that and said, you know, this is not a show for people with a high-level political or news knowledge. Like, that's not – this is for – everyday people. This is for people who really don't have a huge grasp on the news, maybe are interested in getting more politically involved. These are for people who don't understand heavy legal political jargon. That's who this show is for, and I've always been completely open about that. And oh my God, it was so crazy. I think we could ease the concern of MAGA on Biden's health if we simply put him and Trump on a bicycle at the bottom of a hill and see who can reach the top. What? I don't fucking know. Then a lot of comments about how female comedians aren't funny. Deb added again. She says, At one point I mentioned that it would be nice to see a stronger third party candidate. And she goes, stronger third candidate. How much research does Philanthropy Girl actually do? I don't know. And then she follows up and says, please list your news sources that form your opinions. They're in every episode of every podcast. Who is this that you're showing me right now, Michael?
He's not on the screen, but so this is one thing. When Washington Journal sent out a tweet about this.
Yeah.
This guy said, I'm working at Allegheny General Hospital in Pittsburgh, and the old lady patient told me that I should find a nice girl like this one on TV. Maybe I should hit on her at Skankfest.
Oh, are you serious? This guy's hot.
Yeah.
This guy's a looker. What's his name?
Colin.
Colin? Ugh, me and Christina can't have boyfriends with the same name.
Okay.
That's
How
too cute.
How cute is that?
No! I'll ask him if I can call you by your middle name, Colin. Maybe we'll have a date at Skankfest.
What about one of you claims Colin, one of you has to call their guy Collie?
Collie? Oh, God. I mean, I like it because it's a type of dog, but I don't know about that. This guy's hot, though. I'm into it. I mean, the way he takes a selfie is weird, but I mean, hopefully he's younger than me, and then the selfie will be okay.
He's a little younger than you.
How do you know?
I mean, he's got 88 in his bio. I'm assuming.
Oh, he was born in 88.
He's either born in 88 or not someone you want to date.
Right. What?
Yeah, it's a coded thing.
What does 88 mean?
88, it's the eighth letter of the alphabet twice, HH.
What does that mean?
HH?
Yeah.
Hail somebody.
Oh, my God. Well, I mean, it's... I think it's pretty obvious.
Sorry, I speak internet.
No, it's okay. yeah, but you speak a different side of the internet. I speak like I can speak TikTok and like ASMR and stuff like that. You speak like the little avatars of the frog face. What's that guy called?
I'm fluent in Pepe.
Yeah, Pepe. I was like, what's it called? I haven't heard that in a while since I dumped my ex-boyfriend. Okay. Many boyfriends ago. All right, and then let's go to clip two. This is Brenda from Pennsylvania. This was special. This was a special one. Oh my God! And then, I mean, it's just I got up at 7 a.m. after working until like 2 a.m. to do this. So pretty crazy that I was awake and had to handle this.
We need a stronger third candidate. Is what we need.
Brenda is in Indiana, Pennsylvania, on our Democratic line. Go ahead, Brenda.
Hey, good morning. I was so glad to hear you use the phrase
"the human cigarette."
Critical thinking early on in your talking there. I think one of the biggest problems we have in this country is that too many people are willing to grab onto a buzzword and believe that explains the whole issue. So I think we need more critical thinking. And second, I was very glad whenever you addressed the topic of transgenders. What I would like to know
is, we're in trouble now.
The transgender conversation is so one-sided. I would like to know why no one talks about the congenital birth defect of hermaphrodism.
Here we go.
It is a congenital birth defect. It is documented. It is researched. And it is a condition where a person is born with both male and female body parts. Both.
All right, Brenda, let's give Karina a chance to respond.
You know what? When I came to Washington, D.C., I did not know that I was going to be talking about hermaphrodites this early in the morning.
Welcome to C-SPAN.
The funny thing is, in my act last night, somehow during crowd work, hermaphrodites did come up. So I feel like this is kismet. I don't really have a lot of expertise on the area besides that I once read that Jamie Lee Curtis was born with both male and female parts, and that's as far as we can go on there. I feel like that's just not my realm. And then the other thing she was talking about was critical thinking. Yeah, I agree. Critical thinking is extremely important. So thank you. It's more like just teaching people to read news and not have it simply align with their political ideology or like identity politics when we talk about that. Actually, read the story. Yeah, almost like cover where the it's from. Just read the words and then go, how do I think? How do I feel about that? What do I think about that? It seems almost like a preschool level exercise, but I feel like it will help people just know how they feel about something rather than be like, how am I supposed to feel about this? How will my friends want me to feel about this?
Hmm. All right, Dennis, cool. Thank you so much. All right. Also, I wanted to retract my comment about being a human cigarette. It was funny because I did in my head picture a human cigarette, but that now I'm stooping to the people on Twitter's level and commenting on her voice because I did appreciate the first part of Brenda's call. And it's also funny because on C-SPAN, they actually have different phone lines, if you notice, if you're watching the video version of this, for the different political parties. So there's one line you call if you're a Democrat, one line you call if you're a Republican, and one line you call if you're in an independent, which I thought was interesting. Jim was a Republican. Brenda identified as a Democrat and then said that she thought that the transgender discussion was very one-sided. And then by her use of, you know, quote, transgenders, I was confused which side Brenda thought was one, like, what is the one-sided conversation that she's thinking? Because if you're a Democrat, you're assuming that you are, you know, across the board pro-LGBTQ, but then she used the actual word transgenders, which, you know, I mean, okay. And then it just devolved into a discussion about hermaphrodites, and I don't even really know how we got there. Also, if anyone's saying, you know, at home saying the rumor about Jamie Lee Curtis being a hermaphrodite has been dispelled. Listen, it says that it's false on Snopes. It is an internet rumor. I was just bringing it up to be silly. Whether or not it's actually true, I don't know. Jamie Lee Curtis has denied it in interviews. That doesn't mean it's not true. There's lots of things that celebrities deny in interviews that we don't know if they're true or not. It's probably just like a urban legend in Hollywood. But, you know, listen, when you call with a silly question or comment, you're going to get a silly response. And that's how we got there. I don't know what discussion she thinks we need to be having about being a hermaphrodite. I don't think there's any discussion. I think it's your own body, and then you can have the discussion about it. And usually when someone is born, you know, a hermaphrodite, it's like they have one main body part, you know, the primary one that is associated most times with their sex at birth. And then they have like a nub of the other one. It's not like you have two. It's not like you have a huge schlong and a huge puss. Like, that's not what usually happens as far as I have been notified. Mike, have you been notified? Have you ever had sex with someone who had both male and female genitalia?
No, my genuine question was going to be, do you think that she was calling in because she herself was born a hermaphrodite and is like, in all this talk of the transes,
why not me?
Yeah, no one is paying attention to me, somebody who was actually born this way.
I hope so. And more power to you, Brenda. I don't know. But yeah, it was a absolutely wild morning on C-SPAN. If you're interested in watching the whole 45-minute interview, Michael put that link in the description of the podcast. My manager is currently watching. I told him, I said, don't waste your time watching the whole thing. But he's like, no, I have it on and I'm working. And he's like, this is a hoot. So I'm glad that he could enjoy it. All right, so you guys know I'm not drinking right now, but I do enjoy these products, and man, it almost makes me want to start drinking again to test if this is truly the strongest of the capsules on the market, okay? If you're interested in really fucking challenging Capsulite, testing what it's worth, saying, can you handle the damage I'm about to do to my liver? Can you make my liver come out supreme? What you're going to do is you're going to go to the link in the show description, and a 30% off coupon code will automatically be applied. And if for some reason that doesn't work, just use coupon code GAS, G-A-S, all right? Capsulite. You're not getting your life together, so have a pill do it for you. Back to the show. I'm going to move on to the Wacko Mailbag. Again, if you want to email me, it's withoutacountrypodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much. You can include either a response to something that we talk about on an episode. You can pitch a new topic to me. You can share an article with me. You can any of those things. Just don't, you know, those are the kind of things. Or, you know, again, sometimes people email me if they want me to appear on, you know, some type of political podcast or something like that. Just keep it specific to Without a Country. That is all I ask. And so we got actually three great responses to our conversation about Abigail Schreier's new book, Bad Therapy, last week. And you can watch that episode if you are not caught up. And I wanted to share those because I love teachers and I really wanted to hear the perspective of people who are currently in the classroom teaching. It's been a long time since I've been in a classroom. And again, my mom's a teacher, but I think, like, you know, there's different things happening all over our great country. This one says, "Hey, Corinne, I'm writing in response to the Abigail Schreier article. As a former teacher, I was floored by how spot on she was. I even have one of those ankle tattoos she so astutely observed at the convention. Anyway, I taught elementary school and have a bachelor's and master's degree from the School of Education at a prestigious university in Boston. Although I identify as liberal, I have recently found myself agreeing with some leading conservative voices, hey, Jordan Peterson, when it comes to criticism of our education system and teacher training. I completely disagree that nearly all kids today have suffered serious traumatic experiences that leave them unable to learn. Around 70 to 80% of elementary teachers are white women, and I noticed there is a lot of white savior behavior happening in schools. There are absolutely adults in school who play therapist. To make matters worse, at school, the teacher, at school, the school I worked at, these were usually paraprofessionals or even college-age student teachers who had even less training and administrative oversight. This is completely inappropriate. However, context is important. The buzzwords and practices Schreier writes about represent overcorrections in the field of education. For example, social emotional learning and restorative justice practices were implemented in response to the strict and ineffective zero tolerance policies from the 90s and 2000s. Around the same time, the Bush administration signed the No Child Left Behind Act, which I remember pretty vividly. Evidence shows that these old policies negatively impacted student learning, disproportionately impacting minority students, specifically Black and brown boys from low socioeconomic status, and widened the achievement gap. Like you always say, both sides have their issues. During my own college education, I was shocked at the amount of lecture time that was dedicated to social emotional learning and critical race theory as opposed to practical teaching skills such as the different reading models or classroom management strategies. This is coming from someone who sees value in all of these topics. I think a well-rounded college education includes courses in which students critically consider different theories and ideologies. I even think these topics can be taught in high school if led by a competent teacher. However, when a specific viewpoint is injected into nearly every course, regardless of the topic being covered, that is indoctrination. For example, I have been assigned to read Pedagogy of the Oppressed by Paulo Freire in several courses at both the undergraduate and graduate levels. I don't even necessarily disagree with most of the points Freire makes, but when this text popped up in my course about teaching elementary kids earth science, I started to get suspicious. My university was sacrificing academic rigor to further an ideological agenda. To be fair, I suppose there were opportunities to voice different opinions. Professors did make a point to say you could challenge their views during class, office hours, or on final exams. However, I constantly found myself asking, is this the hill I want to die on? Looking back, I regret that I did not push back more, especially during class discussions. If I had, perhaps other students would have felt more comfortable to share their views. And again, I think that's like an important point. Often, like, it takes a kind of a ballsier person to start the cry out that I don't feel the same way you do, and then other people will feel more comfortable to get on the bandwagon. Okay, let's see. But at the end of the day, I was a working student who just wanted to graduate. I have my own bizarre experience in one of the faux therapy sessions Schreier writes about. To pay for my graduate studies, I participated in a teacher core program. This program required, among other things, that I participate in weekend retreats every few months. The purpose of these retreats was supposedly to provide personal and professional mentorship. However, these retreats always devolved into, at best, a casual bitch and moan session, and at worst, a wildly uncomfortable experience among peers, coworkers, and program supervisors. Sometimes we had to discuss our identity, including our degrees of privilege and oppression. During one memorable retreat, we all sat in a circle in a dimly lit conference room and were instructed to talk about something we were struggling with. My supervisor, who is not even a licensed educator or professional development coach, and definitely not a therapist, started talking about her relationship with her husband and young children and burst into tears. And this is what I talk about when I say, I know some people, especially when we've discussed this on Guys We Fucked, a lot of people gave me pushback when I said, you can't cry at work. I'm going to stand by that. I mean, sure, if someone dies on the job, you know, but like, you really can't, I really stand by that. I just don't think you can be crying at work. It's inappropriate, because to me, it's not that you can't feel feelings at work. It's not that you can't do your job and also mix in empathy at your place of work. That's not at all what I'm saying. To me, there is something about the inability to control your emotions in the moment, whether it be sadness, anger, whatever it is, that says you are not a competent leader, right? So especially if you're a teacher, you are leading a classroom. If you can't control your emotions, and I mean, I'm not talking about if a fucking school shooter comes in, but I'm talking about like if people are having a conversation, you should really be able to kind of be prepared for anything and not maybe breaking down crying. Like if my teacher started crying in front of me, and it's happened once or twice over the years, that to me says this person isn't in control of the situation. It's the same thing as being a comedian. When the heckling gets so intense that you lose control of the room, the comedian's not steering the ship anymore. And people sense that. And I think it's a problem. She goes on to say, some of my peers talked about eating disorders and we couldn't move on until everyone shared. What the fuck? I ended up talking about how I feared I made the wrong career choice. It felt like a cult. That's so funny. I am currently in law school and my educational experience has been completely different compared to my experience in the school of education. Professors not only encourage but require students to consider and argue for ideas that are fundamentally different than our own. I wish my college and graduate education was as rigorous as my law school education. Teaching is incredibly challenging and important, and it absolutely is. I fucking love teachers. Our kids deserve teachers that know what the fuck they are doing. Although I am excited about my career in the legal field, I find myself considering homeschooling. I am disappointed with my experience attending the School of Education and teaching in the classroom. Whenever I read articles about social emotional learning, CRT, or gender being taught in schools, I get frustrated because these are important and nuanced topics. And unfortunately, I think a lot of districts and teachers are just winging it. Our kids deserve better. Hopefully, states can pass legislation to rein in some of these ridiculous policies and practices. At the very least, families need to be informed about what is happening in their children's schools so they can decide whether or not their children will participate. And I can't give names for any of these people because they're all educators. This is the second letter. It says, hi, Corinne, longtime fucker and original wacko here. And also a teacher who works in a school that is embracing SEL. I'll give you the facts about what we do as a school first, then my opinions after, so you can decide if you want to cut my soapbox. Please keep my name anonymous. I work in a small, less than 1,000 kids high school in a rural city. Here are some demographics. We are about 2/3 white, about 15% black, 10% Hispanic, and the rest is Asian, Pacific Islander, Native American, two or more races, and other. Almost 2% are English language learners, and 10% are classified as special ed, but both those numbers are increasing. More about that later. Here is some important geography. We are technically a city, but our entire county is farmland. The housing here is relatively cheap, so we have a large number of low-income families. 31% of our students qualify for free/reduced lunch. However, we are situated between two large cities, which means lots of parents can commute there for high-paying jobs and live here. All this to say, we have more diversity than one might expect. So how do we address social-emotional learning? Every school building does monthly circle-up meetings, aka peace circles. These are modeled after Native American restorative practices and used for community building or conflict resolution. This full explanation can be skipped for time. All right. So the kids, I'm interested in this, though. The kids sit in a circle facing each other. There is a talking piece and one or two facilitators. A facilitator who is a teacher or trained student will ask a question to the group, like, what is stressful to you right now? Then pass the talking piece around the circle. Then the facilitator summarizes what everyone said, like, I heard people saying different things, like passing a class or losing the basketball game. Then the talking piece goes around again for the connection round. You'd say something like, I connected with what Johnny said because I'm also stressed about algebra. The next question is maybe, what do you do to relieve your stress? Where everyone shares, then a round of connecting. The last question is something for closure, maybe what are you going to try next time you feel stressed? Sharing round, connecting round, and that's it. We have four school counselors, one social worker, and one therapist who comes in once a week. This is an improvement, as before we had to share one social worker for the whole district. Now each school has their own. Also, the therapist is new this year. Kids can either advocate for themselves and ask to sign up, or teachers can suggest they go. Either way, if they are under 18, they need parent permission. Group sessions are the social worker and one counselor. This is brand new. They are only gathering kids who are interested, and I don't know how it works exactly. I imagine with parental consent. We try math and reading scores, and now also an SEL score. We had a day where all the teachers filled out scores on kids they teach with questions like, how often do they put themselves down, follow what others do, mention violence. Some of these are really interesting to me because it's like, okay, mentioning violence, I can see that. And that's something that you can like, you can just like, that's a number. That's easy. But like, as far as like follow what others do and put themselves down, like I would argue most of these teachers probably haven't even mastered these concepts. And that's my real problem with it. It's like most adults haven't mastered these. So you have the blind leading the fucking blind. So now you can see if a kid is flagged green, yellow, or red for math, reading, and SEL. That's about everything we do as a building district. There's also a heavy push for teachers to do their own thing that feels comfortable and natural to check in on kids. And of course, you should be checking in on kids, but I don't think, considering how far behind America is as a first world country in education, that we should be spending this much classroom time on this shit. And there's a lot of other things that we could be doing. Like, yeah, I agree. It is important to have a grasp on your emotions and to treat each other kindly and with respect. But I think there's ways that you can do that that teach, like, you know, traditional things that you would learn in school and also help you with your, you know, emotional learning, such as debate. Like, debate is a great example of something that teaches writing skills, teaches public speaking, but also teaches you how to control your emotions, how to rein them in when you feel challenged, how to talk to someone who feels differently than you, confidence. It teaches a lot of skills, you know, but just sitting in a circle like therapy style in school, if I was in school during this time, guys, I would even when I was six, I would have wanted to blow my fucking brains out. There's just so many things in school that are set up for the lowest common denominator. And I don't mean like low, stupidest by any means. I just mean like least in touch with themselves. And quite frankly, like, you know, I know it's one for all for one, but I don't need to sit there while you figure out how to navigate your own emotions. Like, I'm here to fucking learn. What's the general, only the monthly circles are mandatory, and even those can be altered if we want. What's the general consensus? Most teachers can't stand the circle ups. And when we had to fill out the forms on each student, we all also, because this is so therapeutic, like, you know, therapists undergo a lot of maintenance, right? So they have learned the skills in becoming licensed professionals in therapy to take care of themselves. It is extremely draining for someone who is not getting that self-care, who has not been taught those tools, to have an added burden of the emotional weight of all these children in their classrooms. Teachers are already overworked and already not paid enough. So now we're adding them taking on the emotional burden of the students they teach on top of that. I just don't think that's a good idea. Most teachers can't stand the circle ups. And when we had to fill out the forms on each student, we all had a look of, is this really what our PD hours are being used for? However, most teachers also think that these kids are not okay. Between COVID, growing up iPad kids, and their entire lives being on internet display since they were infants, they are not okay. Yeah, but that's not your job. Like, parents do have to have a job. Like, this is where I feel a little bit Republican. Like, what the fuck is happening at home? I agree. If someone comes in and they look like they are in danger at home, yeah, send them to the school counselor. But every kid doesn't need this amount of maintenance. Many are stuck developmentally where they were when COVID hit. So we have 10th graders who have the body and hormones of a 15-year-old, but the maturity of an 11-year-old. How do you correct that? You are so right. Teachers have no business playing therapist in class, but a teacher who has taught one thing for the last 10, 15, 20 years suddenly has to change their behavior management style to accommodate that. A large part of why a teacher chooses the age they do is because they can handle that developmental level. I totally agree, and that's so important. And there is such a difference in between the personalities of a grammar school teacher, a middle school teacher, and a high school teacher. But we are being forced into territory we did not sign up for. And yes, and you guys, and I think rather than making these, you know, social emotional circles for kids, maybe teachers need more support. Teachers need more tools, you know? We also have kids whose parents defend their kids' actions. Yeah, spoil little brats. One student destroyed an electronic device by smashing it on the ground, and their parents said they were exploring a curiosity of how things worked. Straight to jail. Parents will defend monstrous behavior to the point that if a teacher calls home and receives support, we brag about it in the lounge. And then there is a kid. I mean, and again, like, fucking, I don't know, suspend those kids, expel them. I don't know what to tell you. Like, it shouldn't be such a democracy about your kid's behavior. If your kid breaks the rules in school, your kid gets suspended. Fuck that. And then there's a kid who goes home to their single parent and they don't talk to each other. Like, no words. Yeah, I mean, that's not really the teacher's job. They will frequently go weeks without saying a word to each other. When they do talk, it's a shouting fight about how the kid needs to move out, get a job, or get a license. That sucks. But again, like, that's where you're going into therapist territory. That kid's going to need help, and, you know, their first girlfriend's going to deal with it. The special ed classification is rising rapidly because nothing about curriculum was changed to account for kids having basically 2 years of instruction missing. They're not special ed. They just didn't learn it. And we forced them to achieve above that anyway. Harkening back to the SEL score we gave kids, nobody said it out loud, but it basically felt like suicide watch and shooter identification. In the last 10 years, we have experienced children dying by suicide. This is a huge problem. I mean, suicide was going on even when I was in high school, so, and I know that those numbers have only gone up since then. I can't even describe how horrible those experiences were. The effects are felt for years, and obviously so much guilt. Teachers, friends, counselors, we all wished for a chance again. Maybe one more adult looking out for a kid might have changed it, maybe not, but teachers are at their very core caretakers. Yeah, we love the subjects, but we love the kids more. I guess you went to a different school than I did. Also, being so rural, we have lots of hunters. We have more guns. I'm sure we have more guns in homes than we feel comfortable admitting. I've been to town council meetings where the rhetoric about guns makes me nervous. I take our lockdown drills very seriously, as, of course, everyone should, I hope. And now we have scores on kids who, if they make a joke about something violent, we can take it seriously. A shooting happened close enough to home. So in summary, I wish that we didn't have to do as much as we do. Teachers are frequently inserting themselves and desperately trying to foster healthy habits, not because we want to, but because we feel like we have to. We don't necessarily know what we're doing, but we can't do nothing. I hear that, but we're also so dumb. I mean, listen, you know, you guys, I went to public school, and that's why I don't know words. And I went to pretty good public school in New Jersey. That elementary teacher who asked the group what they're sad about probably didn't have the qualifications to do so. But how many kids go home to a place that they also can't talk about what makes them sad? And they don't have friends because they grew up isolated online. I've heard Christina from Guys We Fucked. I don't really like to just swap the two shows, but you guys know. I've heard Christina and many others in private settings wonder why they don't teach life skills, like how to get rejected or how to self-soothe in schools. Well, we're trying for better or for worse. My issue is, yes, I think some of these things are good to teach in schools. If you know, more, certainly more helpful than like a home economics class, like, you know, like we took, you know, sewing and cooking and those kind of things. I think these kind of things, if you want to, like, they could be a class that you would choose. Methinks the people who need it most would not choose these classes. And but my problem is that I just don't think teachers are equipped. A therapist is a completely different job. Most therapists who are licensed are barely equipped to be therapists. Ask anyone for, you know, for things that their therapist has said to them. So, and I think when you try to do something that you're not equipped to do, you can quite honestly make things more worse than you can better. That wasn't correctly. You see, look, you need to be teaching me, because that was more worse. That's not the way you say that. There's something else personal for me, and that was from an ESL teacher specifically. And this is the third one. And again, I just think this was really interesting. And this is kind of like the way that we have a conversation, even though this podcast has one host. Also, I love that, Mike, I can see you playing solitaire on the screen in front of me. That's great. That's not distracting at all. Producer of the fucking year. All right. So this last says, hi, Corinne. Longtime listener of both Guys We Fucked Without a Country and appreciate all you do. I am a school counselor at a public high school in Western New York where I work with 9th through 12th graders. After working for years in a chemistry classroom in NYC as an aide and studying to become a chemistry teacher, I realized that I hated the idea of teaching the same subject year after year, but genuinely loved working with high school students and helping them plan for their future. I'm big on building community and building caring relationships with students and their families, and genuinely love my job and the students I work with. In order to be permanently certified as a school counselor in New York State, you must have a 60-credit-hour master's degree, including a year-long internship in a school. All that being said, my job is not to provide counseling sessions to students throughout the school day. We have three main domains that we focus on: academics, career planning, and social emotional wellness. And career planning is so funny to me because I did go to the counselor, as we all had to, senior year of high school, or perhaps it was junior year, to talk about where you were going to college and what career you were going to pursue. And had I listened to my fucking loser counselor, I would not be an artist. This man tried to talk me out of being an artist so hard. And his reasoning was like, you know, what was your backup plan? What if you fail? And even me, Corinne, and this is just like, you know, you guys know I've always been Corinne. But so me at 15, 16, you know, whatever I was at the time, I remember sitting there, and I don't remember the man's name, but I remember sitting across from him as he's telling me this. And obviously it did not at all affect me. I was like, bitch, you're going to be famous. And here I am today. I was sitting there listening to him and kind of thinking about, wow, what does this say about you? You're an adult man, and you are living in fear for me, a teenager, that I might not succeed. I might not achieve my dreams. And I remember in that moment feeling sad, not feeling worried for myself, feeling sad for him, thinking, what did this guy really want to do? And he's sitting here. This is obviously, I can tell by what he's saying and the advice that he's giving me that this is not what he wanted to do for a living. And that made me sad. I was sitting there sad for an adult man. And that's what I say. There's just so many people, and especially because unlike a therapist, you don't get to, choose your teachers until you get to college. You don't get to choose your teachers, not in any public school setting that I've been to. So it's like there's just no vetting process for the kind of adults that your children are being exposed to. And I got to be honest, most adults are fucking losers who did not achieve their dreams. Okay? And that's why this makes me nervous. That's why it makes me nervous. You got to be around adults who are fucking maybe vet it so that they're someone who chose their career goal was to be a teacher and they're happy and they feel good about themselves. And that's not many people I know. Many people who chose to be a teacher, sure, but not many adults who feel good about themselves who I wouldn't fear projecting on these fucking children. That's my issue here. Therapists are trained so that you don't really learn much about them. I knew way too much about every teacher I've ever fucking had, and I think any other public school student would agree. So a therapist not only has the tools and the license, they also know that they are kind of just asking questions to get more out of their client. We're not learning about them. None of their shit should really be rubbing off on you. We focus on academics, career planning, and social emotional wellness, and usually those three things go hand in hand. A major part of my job is to track my assigned students, like 215 students on my caseload, progress towards graduation. I need to know the New York State graduation requirements inside and out and help make plans for students who may veer from a typical path to graduation. I am in charge of my students' schedules, making sure they are in the classes they need in order to graduate, mixed with the classes that make sense for their post-high school plans. A huge part of my job is also helping students apply to college or help students set up their plans for once they graduate. And this is beautiful. Again, something I didn't need because I had active parents at home. I know a lot of kids don't. And I love that these people are here to facilitate people who don't. But, like, don't waste my time with this shit. As for the social emotional wellness of my students, again, I do not provide traditional counseling. We do have social workers and school psychologists who may do a bit more of the counseling than we think of in a traditional sense, but it's usually brief with the goal to get students back to class. And none of us are diagnosing students with mental disorders. We do intervene when students are in crisis and help them come back to baseline or help them access the appropriate support in the community. I work with students, families, doctors, therapists, CPS, et cetera, to help support the students so they can be successful in high school. Sometimes this includes finding an alternative learning environment for a student, like such as tutoring, or looking at special education for a student, or just allowing a student to eat lunch in a smaller location than the cafeteria. You mentioned that the author refers to school counselors as intermediaries between teachers and students, and rarely is that the case. I may go to teachers to double check on how a student is doing in their course because they need the class in order to graduate, or communicate with the teachers before a student enters their classroom to give them a brief history on the student and things to be on the lookout for. But a lot of my job is helping students to learn to advocate for themselves. What I would do to get my hands on my file. I would love to know what the fuck it said about me. I am happy to answer more questions, but I also wanted to touch on in-class social emotional learning, SEL, in the academic world. The district I work in has been pushing SEL and restorative practices. Some major tenets of our work is that any sharing in class must be voluntary, and students always have a right to pass. Again, that's like raising the weak. I was also like, I literally speak professionally to strangers for a living, and I did not love getting called on in class, but man, oh man, did it make me pay attention, more invested in what we were learning. Like, yeah, there, like in life, you have to speak up. And I think just like letting people pass constantly and like being in a room where no one's going to volunteer their opinions, I just don't think that's the right way. This is how you raise weak babies. Sometimes in life, you have to speak up and you don't get a choice. A lot of the work is around building community and teaching resilience. Our big buzzword of the moment is warm openers. And this is usually just a fun way to get students connecting to one another at the beginning of class or making real world connections to the content students are learning in class. And again, it is all voluntary. Of course, as you mentioned, the old timers do not buy into a lot of this, and that is fine. But we have seen some major successes with teachers using these practices to create a community in their classroom throughout the year. I don't want a fucking community. I just want to learn. I don't want to fucking be associated with any of these people, okay? Again, feel free to ask more questions. Okay, moving on. Thank you so much to everyone who wrote. Those are three, you know, diverse opinions on the subject matter, and I wanted to cover them all because, I am not a teacher, and, I haven't been in a classroom in quite some time. And I miss it a little bit. I really love a school setting. It really vibed with me. Moving on to girl. Mike was playing solitaire. He had to scoot over everyone.
I was looking for my soundboard, but I don't have it over here.
Oh, okay. Well, we're in Studio C. That's why we have the green screen up, because we're recording at a different time because Mike needs to go skiing. It's a Gas Digital company trip, right?
This is a work retreat.
It's a work retreat. Oh, speaking of retreats, are you guys going to go in a circle and talk about what makes you feel vulnerable?
No, I mean... You know, put enough chemicals in me and I'll talk about whatever you need me to talk about.
I love it. I'm so jealous. I wish they would ask the host to go. All right. So this is from...
You want to come skiing?
If I had known it in advance, I would 100% come skiing.
Come on. We'll make some room in the house. Come hang.
I have things that I got to do this week, but I would have loved to. I would have really genuinely loved to. Hey, guys. I'm officially just a straight up drug dealer. I'm not even going to try to hide it. You know me. I love transparency. So this copy reads $60 kilos. That's right. The unattainable number that no one in the world of Kratom was able to accomplish until Yo Kratom came along. For years, entrepreneurs, scientists, academics all tried to solve the $60 kilo problem right up there with cancer. And YoKratom.com figured it out. And now, thanks to their sheer brilliance, you can get a kilo of Kratom for just $60. And I mean, guys, if you're buying anything in kilos, you are nailing life. How did they solve the legendary $60 kilo problem? Will anyone else solve the $60 YoKratom kilo problem? There's an assortment of other problems I'd like to solve too after reading this copy. Find out on season 3 of YoKratom. That's right. It's Yo Kratom's third year of being a loyal sponsor of this show right here, Without a Country. So thanks. I want to take the time right now to thank anyone who I've got addicted for you getting addicted to a substance in solidarity with this show. You're the true fucking heroes right now. Thank you for your service. Let's go. Can't believe they wrote that. YoKratom.com, home of the $60 kilo. And whoever wrote this copy, definitely on the $60 kilo. Now back to the show. All right. So this is from NPR. Nikki Haley wins D.C.'s Republican primary. Nikki Haley, baby, she finally won a primary. And in D.C., I feel like maybe it was my aura there that helped her win.
Record.
What?
First time ever a conservative woman won a Republican primary.
Oh.
Won a Republican contest on a national level of any scale.
Yeah. And I was like, you know what? It made me happy for her because she's really staying in it, you know? Good for you. You got one victory. And I think, like, you know, people are kind of questioning why is she staying in so long. I think it's to, like, make a splash. So we remember her name? How many of these, you know, candidates who, you know, don't go on to win the nomination do we actually remember? And I think this is going to prove, like, hey, she's resilient. I think it really speaks to someone's character when they keep losing and they keep going. Like, I really do think there is something to say about that. Nikki Haley has won the Republican primary in the District of Columbia, notching her first victory of the 2024 campaign. Her victory Sunday at least temporarily halts Donald Trump's sweep of the GOP voting contests, although the former president is likely to pick up several hundred more delegates in this week's Super Tuesday races. Despite her early losses, Haley has said she would remain in the race at least through those contests, although she has declined to name any primary she felt confident she would win. Following her loss in her home state of South Carolina, Haley remained adamant that voters in the places that followed deserved an alternative to Trump despite his dominance thus far in the campaign. The Associated Press declared Haley the winner Sunday night after D.C. Republican Party officials released the results. She won all 19 delegates at stake. It's not surprising that Republicans closest to Washington dysfunction are rejecting Donald Trump and all his chaos, Haley spokesperson Olivia Perez Cubas said in a statement, noting that Haley became the first woman, as Mike said, to win a Republican primary in history. Washington is one of the most heavily Democratic jurisdictions in the nation, with only about 23,000 registered Republicans in the city. Democrat Joe Biden won the district in the 2022 general election with 92% of the vote. I also think that's an interesting point, to talk about, you know, that our nation's capital is one of the most heavily Democratic jurisdictions in the nation. And even though I am, you know, as we mentioned on C-SPAN, a liberal gone rogue, I think shouldn't we want more Republicans so that we could have this conversation? Like, if we have two parties, why aren't they there? Like, I actually would like them there. I feel the same way about this stat the way I feel about comedy. Like, do I agree mostly with, like, the left-leaning comedians? Are most comedians left-leaning? Yeah, but I want to hear the voices of the right. I want to hear your humor. I want to hear what you have to say. We know you exist, and you should have a voice, quite frankly. Trump's campaign issued a statement shortly after Haley's victory, sarcastically congratulating her on being named Queen of the Swamp by the lobbyists and D.C. insiders that want to protect the failed status quo. Trumpian Trump. Haley held a rally in the nation's capital on Friday before heading back to North Carolina and a series of states holding Super Tuesday primaries. She joked with more than 100 supporters inside. Politicians need to fucking leave the jokes to the comedians. Enough of this joking. Like, our country is, we're in shambles. Please take it seriously. She joked with more than 100 supporters inside a hotel ballroom. Who says there's no Republicans in D.C.? Come on. We're trying to make sure that we touch every hand that we can and speak to every person, Haley said. Please don't touch my hand. As she gave her standard campaign speech criticizing Trump for running up federal deficit, one rally goer bellowed, "He cannot win a general election. It's madness." That prompted agreement from Haley, who argues that she can deny Biden a second term, but Trump can't. While campaigning as an avowed conservative, Haley has tended to perform better among more moderate and independent-leaning voters. 4 in 10 Haley supporters in South Carolina's GOP primary were self-described moderate, compared with 15% for Trump, according to AP Votecast, a survey of more than 2,400 voters taking part in the Republican primary in South Carolina, conducted by Associated Press by NORC at the University of Chicago. On the other hand, 8 in 10 Trump supporters identified as conservatives, compared to about half of Haley's backers. Trump won an uncontested D.C. primary during his 2020 reelection bid, but placed a distant third 4 years earlier behind Senator Marco Rubio of Florida and former Ohio Governor John Kasich. Rubio's win was one of only three in his unsuccessful 2016 bid. Other more centrist Republicans, including Mitt Romney and John McCain, won the city's primaries in 2012 and 2008 on their way to winning the GOP nomination. So that was nice. We've been covering Nikki Haley, talking about her for a while. Honestly, I was happy for her. Good girl. I'm glad for you. You got a little win there. Good for you. Good for you. All right, I want to move on. Looking at the time here. All right. Yeah, it was an interesting week. There wasn't like that many major stories, which is why I spent so much time on those responses to the bad therapy article we read last week from Free Press. This is a little bit more of an emotional thing. I didn't know where to place it, but I thought it was a good story, and it was something that I was emailed from the Washington Post, so something, an article that they were really proud and excited about. It's from the On Your Mind section of the Washington Post. It says, why quitting can be a superpower that helps your mental health. And this really spoke to me because I think as I age, that's one thing that I've been getting much better at is quitting things when they're not working, when they're not working for me, when they're taking up more time and energy than I think they are worth. I think often overachievers are raised not to be quitters, but I think, you know, sometimes, not always, sometimes quitting is the best thing that you can do for yourself. And I think it's, you know, it's growing up is learning to discern when to quit and when to not. So some months back, one of my patients, a man in his 50s, and this is just so you know, it's by Gregory Scott Brown, MD. So that's why he's saying patients. It's an advice column by him. Some months back, one of my patients, a man in his 50s, told me, I'm burned out. I should look for a new job. I'm just there doing what I need to do to get by. A few weeks later, he told me he had been laid off. How do you feel about that? I asked. Surprisingly good, he said with a sigh. I should have quit years ago. Many of my patients ask me to help them quit. Usually it's something unhealthy, such as smoking or gambling, but a few ask me to help them quit a job or relationship or a long-term project. For me, I definitely have trouble letting go, or used to letting go of long-term projects, because you go, well, what if the next thing that we do with this long-term project is going to be the thing? Am I letting people down? And I got to say, especially in comedy, no one's ever had any problem letting me down on a long-term project. And those people have gone on to be quite successful, things that many of us value. Many people think, and you might too, that quitting reflects laziness, inadequacy, or failure. For me, in my experience, I think it, you know, I think I associate it actually a lot with selfishness. And I know so many of you watching think I'm probably the most selfish person on the planet because of how in love I am with myself and how I advocate for myself. But I would say that I give way too much of myself to other people. And that's been something that I've been working on. I cannot help every fucking underdog that's ever lived, even, you know, like I'm running a human rescue service. From the time we are children, we are taught that nobody likes a quitter. My work, however, has taught me that quitting itself isn't the problem. And quietly quitting, doing the bare minimum like my patient had been doing, can be a form of avoidance. But knowing how and when to quit is a superpower that can benefit your mental health. Persevering at all costs can be harmful. Quitting is a normal and healthy human behavior. 30% of students who entered college in 2011 changed their major at least once in their first 3 years, according to a survey by the National Center for Education Statistics. And in 2023, more than 3 million U.S. workers quit their jobs every month. I think COVID really, and this includes me, taught us how to be comfortable quitting, right? Because it basically forced us to quit a lot of things, whether it be people, you know, romantic relationships, jobs. And then in that silence, in that peace, in that separation, we learned that we were doing those things out of habit and not out of passion. But while people can quit one thing, they might find it difficult to quit another thing. Also, quitting prematurely can lead to a sense of regret. Persevering at all costs, though, can inhibit our ability to adapt, grow, or explore new opportunities, and sometimes to achieve our goals. For instance, being stuck in a toxic relationship can make starting a family tougher. Quitting allows us to pivot and move forward, sometimes in a different and better direction. When you should quit. Knowing when to quit, whether you want to leave a startup company or a committee at your church, is a personal decision, but these symptoms can help you decide if you should quit. Anxiety, feeling restless or keyed up for at least 6 months, burnout, that's me. Physical and emotional exhaustion, feeling cynical about your life most days, depression, feeling worthless, changes in sleep or appetite, or experiencing suicidal thoughts for at least 2 weeks. And I would also add on to that, if you feel like you're showing up for other people more than you're showing up for yourselves, if you're showing up because you don't want to let other people down, it's time to quit. Let them down. Emotional stress is a major contributor to some of the leading causes of death in the United States, including coronary artery disease, cancer, and suicide. Weigh the health risks of the stress from persevering against the benefits to decide if it is time to move on. How to quit smarter. Smart quitting means not only deciding when it's time to quit, but also deciding what you need to quit. Early in medical school, students learn to triage cases by tending to the most urgent ones first, such as cardiac events or oversprained ankles. You can take a similar triage approach when deciding what to quit. One of my patients, you know, because sometimes we just realize that we need less in our lives, and then you have to weigh those things in your life and go, what can go and what can't go. One of my patients, a woman in her 30s, initially came to see me for depression and burnout. She had a stressful job and was involved in many committees related to her children's extracurricular activities. Taking a triage approach, she realized that her most urgent responsibility was to financially support her family. She then saw that quitting some of the extracurricular committees would allow her to find a better work-life balance. This change allowed her to be more emotionally present and less exhausted when she was with her children. Exactly. Like, you're on all these boards for your children, you know, to decide what's going on in their schools. But, like, isn't it more important to just spend that one-on-one time with your children? Steps to quit. I often reference scientist B.G. Fogg's formula for behavioral change, B equals MAP, when teaching my patients how to quit. Fogg suggests that for a new behavior, B, to take place, three things must converge: motivation, M, ability, A, and a prompt, P. In my practice, I have found that it's the lack of a prompt to trigger a sense of urgency that usually keeps my patients from quitting when they need to. Having a quitting timeline, whether it's 1 month or 1 year, and sticking to it can serve as that prompt. And that's, you know, for an example, right? With running my store, my dad's business, I, first of all, when I started it, I put a absolute maximum of 5 years on it. I didn't voice that, but that was, I set that in my heart for myself. I put an absolute maximum of 5 years on it. I said, this is not your main career. You cannot spend more than 5 years dedicated to this project, right? And then pretty soon when, you know, things change with Tops, you know, Fanatics, et cetera, once again, fuck you, Michael Rubin. I hope you are having the worst day of your life every single day. I hope every day gets worse and worse. I was talking about it with John, and he was like, well, we could kind of leave it open-ended. And I said, no, if we're deciding to close the store, we need to set a date. Otherwise, we will never commit to this. And also setting a date and making that finality real allows you to prepare more successfully for the end of something, and really also allows you to be at peace with the ending instead of this constant state of anxiety, right? Like, even when someone is sick, that's part of what makes you anxious. Even if you know they're going to die, it's not so much the fact that they're going to die that's giving you an anxiety. It's the when are they going to die that's giving you the constant anxiety. I knew my dad was going to die after his second cardiac arrest. It was the not knowing when that was the problem that deeply affected my health, because you never know, you know, you don't know what to do. You can't divvy up your time. You go, how much time do I spend with him today? I don't know. Had I known, you know, oh, he has 3 weeks to live, I would have been like, hold all my calls. I'm going to go sit in hospice for 3 weeks, you know? But if he's going to live for 6 months, you can't, unfortunately, sit in hospice by his side for 6 months. You just, maybe some people can. I wouldn't be able to do that for, you know, many reasons, for commitments, for financial reasons, for, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So here you go. In my practice, I found that it's the lack of a prompt to trigger a sense of urgency that usually keeps my patients from quitting when they need to. Having that quitting timeline, whether it's 1 month or 1 year, and sticking to that can serve as a prompt. Here are some steps you can take. Number one, set a quit date. Two, leading up to it, modify the things you can control, such as incorporating more self-care into your life or setting boundaries with your time while weighing the risks versus benefits of quitting. And again, I'll apply this to the store. Things that concerned me or worried me about the store previously, in these final months, I go, doesn't matter. Whatever happens, happens. I don't need to micromanage these things anymore. It's whatever happens is okay. This next thing, plan what your new life might look like after you have quit. I have a tour ready to go, and I will see you in all those cities. As your date approaches, give yourself permission to move on if you need to. So for me, this includes a lot of emotional work that I'm doing, right? This was like a basically an immersive grieving experience that I set up for myself. And it was wonderful and it worked beautifully. And I put so much work into it, so much emotional work, so much physical work. I haven't done this much physical labor in a very, very long time, just moving boxes constantly. Emotional work and I dedicated, and invested a lot of, you know, money into these things and also, had to learn a completely new, I knew some about a lot about the industry from growing up in it, but learned a lot about sports, learned about running my own business. So I invested a lot of time and, the pursuit of knowledge into these things. So, for me, I need to move on, from this project that I did. You know, and I got what I needed out of it. So that's, you know, I'm very at peace with that. And then also, but there is this part of me that needs to move on from, like, I don't get to spend all this time, like, in my dad's stuff, which was extremely healing. And so feelings of missing him and grieving him and the reminder that I'll never see him again, you know, in this lifetime, that's, you know, I need to revisit that a little bit because I had this as a bit of a crutch for a while, right? And so I've healed so much, but I need to give myself to permission to move on from that. And it doesn't mean that I let my dad down or, you know, that I am no longer thinking about him, that, you know, but I know that he would have wanted me to pursue my primary thing, which is comedy. So again, just an example, but whatever that thing is for you. Quitting doesn't have to be permanent. And I've thought about that too. I go, you know, maybe later in life I'd set up a store again. I love memorabilia. I love collectibles. And, you know, it wouldn't need to be rushed. And I don't even need to be associated with sports. Maybe it's a horror collectible store. Again, it's just like, it's never the end until it's the end, right? Quitting doesn't have to be permanent. We typically think about quitting as a permanent change, but depending on what you are quitting, it doesn't have to be. After you have successfully quit, ask yourself how you feel in your new life. Work on building new skills and learning about yourself. Some of my patients who started small businesses and realized that they weren't ready ended up closing their businesses. That wasn't my reasoning, but I mean, I just have the utmost empathy for anyone running a small business. God bless. Like, you set out to do something different, and you're most likely not going to become rich for it, and you're still fucking doing it. Kudos to you. It is such a challenge to run a small business, and like, fuck yeah for trying. Only to try again years later with great success. Like, trial and error. So many things are like that. Others have gone through a divorce, and rather than quitting on marriage altogether, remarried and had a long-lasting second marriage. That's very common, I think. Quitting is sometimes because you learn how to navigate marriage the first time around. Unfortunately, the first time your first spouse is your practice spouse. And that's not for everyone. I think a lot of times that's for people who get married young. Quitting is sometimes necessary and can be approached without shame. But since quitting can lead to dramatic changes in your life, it's not a decision that should be taken lightly. With a little thought and planning, you can decide if quitting is right for you. So I just thought that because I have a very long and sometimes tumultuous relationship with quitting. And one of the best things that I've done for myself in the past several years is being comfortable with quitting. It's okay to quit. It doesn't mean you failed. Right. And again, like, sometimes other people will have a perceived notion of what success means to them. Right. You know, I think a lot of people look at a small business. And again, I'm just using my store as an example because it's something I'm literally, you know, quitting in quotes this month or wrapping up. I think a lot of people think, oh, you didn't become a millionaire, you know, from this store, or there wasn't lines out the door. I mean, we actually did pretty well. We were the toast of the town. You don't know what someone's goals were. Like, my goal wasn't to necessarily become, you know, the top baseball card store in New York. My goal was to honor my dad and to sell, and logistically to sell off some of his collection. And then the third thing was just, quite frankly, I had always wanted to run a store. And I go, well, my dad died and he had a store and he left it. And it's right there. Do it now. I wasn't ready to do it. I wasn't planning on doing it, but it's something I wanted to do. And I said, just do something because you fucking wanted to do it. Like, I have such a problem with not allowing myself to do things just for the experience or just for the fun. Like, I have to be the best at everything I do. And it was so nice just to do something, to fucking do it, just to try something, just to dive in. Like, it was... I learned so much. Like, I learned there, you know, when you choose to be an artist, a lot of times, like, you're choosing it in part to avoid the monotony of life. But then, just like anything, even being an artist becomes monotonous in a way. And so it was so lovely to break up that monotony by doing something like completely on a whim. I made the decision pretty quickly. And just to it was so out of character for me, really. It wasn't, what wasn't out of character was taking on way, not too much, but just like so much, like just maxing myself out. I don't believe that there is anything in this world that is more than I can, biting off more than I can chew. But it was like maxing myself out for sure. And that's just who I am. And that's fine. But yeah, it was I feel like I really learned more in this 3 years with the store than I have learned probably in the past 10 years of my life as far as like business and stuff like that goes. Emotionally, I've learned lots of things from lots of different experiences. All right. Quitting. And then, all right, so the top story of the week, I'm actually going to go with, this was at the top of every news source. And I don't know why, it feels to me like a distraction, right? And so there was so much talk today about the UN report finding that reasonable grounds to believe that people were sexually assaulted on October 7th. We kind of already knew about this. We kind of already knew that Hamas had raped people. And to see this at the top of every news page, like I understand that this we need to announce the results of the United Nations report. But it just felt that like this was the top story on every major news source I visited today. It felt like a distraction from the larger thing that was happening, which is the death toll in Gaza. And like, God, I mean, I've dedicated the past 10 plus years of my life to things like sexual assault. But like when this many people are fucking dead, there's almost a part of me that's like, I don't even care about this report. Like, this death toll is outrageous. And I feel weird saying that, but I also felt it was just very weird that this was just the top story everywhere, you know? I don't know. A team of United Nations experts tasked with gathering information, this is from the Washington Post as a reminder, on sexual violence linked to Hamas's October 7th attacks on Israel found reasonable grounds to believe that people were sexually assaulted at multiple locations that day. Yeah, I would assume so. It's war. And unfortunately, this is something that happens during war. It's not okay. I'm a fucking pacifist through and through. As part of its inquiry, the UN team interviewed survivors and witnesses of the October 7th attacks. Though they did not speak with any survivors of the alleged sexual violence on October 7th, Pramila Patton, the UN Special Representative of the Secretary General on Sexual Violence and Conflict, said in a news conference. And I know like part of the reason they're reporting is because like this is against, you know, the rules of war. But I mean, just like, you know, slaughtering people are in their own village also. That's also not okay. The civilian death toll is barbaric. And then a companion piece to that, not exactly aligned, but this is from the Free Press. Again, it's for the FP.com. There is another thing called the Free Press. That's not what I'm reading from it. This is the FP.com by Barry Weiss. This is titled, Could October 7th Bring Down the Squad by Eli Lake. The progressive House wing's harsh criticism of Israel is out of step with voters, and it could cost three members their seats. Okay, by November, and I think this is especially interesting going into a big election. By November last year, Democratic Representative Summer Lee realized she had to mend fences with Pittsburgh's Jews. Since the October 7th atrocity in Israel, Lee had started to notice to sound like she was on Team Hamas, and Jewish leaders were taking notice. She had voted against the resolution condemning the Hamas attacks and co-sponsored legislation calling for an immediate ceasefire, along with other members in the House's eight-strong ultra-progressive squad. But And just when I say the squad, I just want to say it, that's AOC, Rashida Tlaib, Ayanna Pressley, Summer Lee, Jamal Bowman, Corey Bush, Ilhan Omar, and Greg Cesar. That's who they're referring to as the squad. But in Pennsylvania's 12th congressional district, Lee has run into trouble. On the evening of February 12th, as Israel Defense Forces rescued two hostages from Rafah, Lee posted on X that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's war is indefensible. Which I don't think is a crazy thing to say, all right? As long as we send weapons and a blank check, we're more than complicit in the nearly 30,000 lives lost, she added. This month, she also congratulated a Carnegie Mellon professor for receiving tenure after she compared Israel to Nazi Germany for its conduct during the Gaza War. Yeah, I mean, I just don't think there's any – I understand this because you – it's like – that's almost gaslighting, right? To compare Jews to Nazis. Like, that's just never going to go over well. And, like, what are you even doing there? I don't know. Lee's comments prompted 40 Pittsburgh rabbis and cantors to sign an open letter on October 30th. Expressing their frustration and anger over her ongoing actions. The next month, Lee agreed to meet Jewish leaders to discuss their concerns. It didn't go well. The impression of the Jewish community is that Summer Lee has not served us, said Yitzi Ganak, the chief rabbi of Shar Torah, one of the largest synagogues in Lee's district. Ganak, who attended the first meeting, told the Free Press the two sides were not able to find common ground. We didn't hear sympathy. Episodes like this have led the Jewish communities in Pittsburgh and others in Pennsylvania's 12th district to seek an alternative to Lee in her upcoming primary. And Lee is not the only one facing such a backlash. Now, for the first time since the 2018 swearing in of its inaugural class, the squad could be shrinking as its defamation of Israel after October 7th has repelled old school liberals and centrist Democrats. I think there's a big problem that people have who don't understand what Israel means to Jews, of like needing to separate Israel from Jews. Like, I cannot reiterate how separate those two concepts are. Being Jewish and being Israeli, or living in Israel or being Zionist, those are all very different concepts. And additionally, especially going off of, you know, before October 7th, there was already such an uptick in anti-Semitism and a violent hostility towards the Jewish community that immediately, like, sympathy for that the group immediately went out the window. And I, you know, that's going to be remembered, right? The more well-known squad members, such as AOC, Rashida Tlaib, and Ayanna Pressley, are running unopposed in their primaries this year. No one should ever be running unopposed. Like, that, to me, is a huge problem. Someone should always step up. Ilhan Omar is facing three challengers in a race she is largely expected to win, but three newer members of the squad, albeit from the JV team, are facing serious, well-funded Democratic primary opponents who could knock them from their seats. They are Representative Summer Lee, the 36-year-old lawmaker who has been in office only 1 year, is being challenged by Bhavini Patel, a 30-year-old borough council representative from the Pittsburgh suburb of Edgewood. Raised in Monroeville, Pennsylvania, by a mother who started a food truck business selling samosas, Patel, who is Hindu, calls herself a strong supporter of Israel. She told the Free Press of Lee, "You have a Congress member who consistently votes against the Jewish community. Again, I would separate those two. Israel is not the Jewish community. This is the kind of thing we have to reject as Democrats." So far, Patel's campaign team said they have raised $310,000, an estimated quarter of which comes from pro-Israel sources. Meanwhile, only 38% of constituents hold a favorable view of Lee, according to an October survey. Representative Jamal Bowman, elected in 2020 to serve New York's 16th congressional district, Bowman, 47, is facing a tough race from the Westchester County Executive George Latimer, 70. For the fourth quarter of 2023, Latimer raised nearly $1.4 million, while Bowman raised just $725,000. Meanwhile, J Street, a group that fashions itself as a liberal alternative to the mainstream pro-Israel lobby, pulled its endorsement of Bowman last month after he repeatedly referred to Israel's war as a genocide. And I don't know, I guess because they think it is, so many people think it is Israel defending themselves, that's like the problem that they have with the terminology genocide. But to me, when you look up the definition of genocide, the deliberate killing of a large number of people from a particular nation or ethnic group with the aim of destroying that nation or group, I just don't see how you could argue that. I can't. It's a genocide that is happening 100%. When a large percentage of your population no longer exists, I mean, and I know they're saying it's, you know, because the hostages aren't released. That can't be the only thing that you say in return anymore. And also, unfortunately, like, I think it's really it's been talked about that a lot of the hostages that, unfortunately, that we think that we had originally thought were still alive are dead. And they know that, right? So now they're just killing. They're just going to continue killing. Killing isn't going to bring back those hostages. It's fucked up, but like this response was just, I mean, we're just way too much. Meanwhile, J Street, a group that fashions itself as a liberal alternative to the mainstream pro-Israel lobby, pulled its endorsement of Bowman last month after he repeatedly referred to Israel's war as a genocide. So far, Latimer said he has endorsements from 9 out of the 12 local Democratic committees in Westchester County. And again, maybe it's the fact, maybe, you know, because people take things so personally, right? Maybe the problem that people have more with the use of genocide is not that it is not a genocide in Gaza, but that it feels like when you say it is a genocide, that somehow feels like an attack on the people of Israel. And I don't at all think that. Many people in Israel want a ceasefire. I don't feel like that's what it is. Saying it's a genocide doesn't say the people of Israel are monsters. I think it says perhaps Netanyahu's a monster, but it doesn't. I don't think it says that Israel is a monster, but I think that's how many people are interpreting it. Representative Cori Bush. Bush, 47, who represents Missouri's 1st Congressional District, is being challenged by the popular black St. Louis County prosecutor Wesley Bell, 49. Last month, the Justice Department opened an investigation into Bush's misuse of campaign funds when she hired her romantic partner and now husband for her security detail. Bush has also been one of the main organizers in the House for an unconditional ceasefire resolution and has called Israel's military response to October 7th ethnic cleansing. I mean, again, I would just argue that both Hamas and Israel's military are trying to ethnic cleanse each other. It just happens that Israel has the resources to do so a lot more. That's my take on it. A poll last week found Bush trailing Bell by 22 points. One of the forces fighting to unseat these incumbents is the Democratic Majority for Israel, a political action committee that raised money to help defeat Bush and Bowman. Mark Melman, the president of the group, told the Free Press, defeating incumbents is extraordinarily difficult, but there are a couple of them who are vulnerable, and I think there will be extraordinary efforts to defeat them. Meanwhile, in December, it was reported that the pro-Israel lobby American Israel Public Affairs Committee, also known as AIPAC, is planning to spend up to $100 million in the 2024 election cycle, with some of it going to challengers to the squad. That is more than double the amount the group spent on the 2022 midterms. AIPAC declined to discuss its political spending for this story. Representative Richie Torres, whose district in the Bronx sits alongside AOC's, refused to knock his fellow Democrat legislators, but said their strident criticism of Israel after October 7th was out of step with most voters in his party. He told the Free Press that the notion that ceasefire now represents the will of the American people is pure fiction. We have to make sure we don't play into that false narrative. The squad has held sway over the left wing of the Democratic Party since its inaugural four members, AOC of New York, Tlaib of Michigan, Omar of Minnesota, and Presley of Massachusetts were first elected to Congress in 2018. Since 2020, four new members have joined its ranks: Lee, Bowman, Bush, and Representative George Cesar of Texas. Cesar does not face a primary opponent this year. In New York State's 16th Congressional District, George Latimer opposes a unilateral ceasefire and is the first non-incumbent to receive AIPAC's endorsement this year. He told the Free Press that his opponent, Bowman, has not secured the local base in his district. He'd like you to think his problems are from an external group of people. They are not. Back in Pittsburgh, Lee has not attacked Patel directly, but Patel blames Lee's supporters for stoking a social media campaign to get her February 7th speaking engagement at her alma mater, the University of Pittsburgh, canceled. Patel's campaign pointed me to a series of retweets from a senior advisor to the Lee campaign, Amelia Winter Rowland, who boosted posts on X that promoted articles insinuating Patel was a front for Hindu nationalists and a puppet of the pro-Israel lobby. On February 6, Patel received an email from the dean of the Honors College at Pitt asking her to reschedule the event for the fall. This would give us the ability to secure a location free from any potential disturbances, Dean Nicola Foote wrote. After the university announced the event was postponed, one of Lee's supporters, Tanisha Long, a local police abolition activist, tweeted her approval. This is why organizing and speaking out are important, she posted on X. We have the ability to push our institutions to do the right thing. I'm glad Pitt made the right decision after pushback from the public. Lee's campaign declined requests from the Free Press for an interview. The three-squad primary battles are a microcosm of a wider war over Israel inside the Democratic Party. On one side, social justice progressives have aligned themselves with the activists blocking traffic for Gaza. Tlaib was censured by the House in November for her harsh condemnation of Israel's war by a vote of 234 to 188, with more than 20 members of her own party voting against her. On October 12th, Omar reposted to X a photo of children gassed in a 2013 Syrian attack that decried the child genocide in Palestine. On the other side are more moderate Democrats and the pro-Israel lobby that champions the Jewish state's right to defend itself against the worst massacre of civilians in its history. Stuck in the middle is a Biden administration that has armed Israel but is also attempting to appease the anti-Israel wing of its party with largely symbolic gestures such as sanctioning four Israeli settlers for violence against Palestinians in the U.S. Bank. And Kamala Harris has been very outspoken about ceasefire now over the past couple of days. I've seen a lot of footage of her talking about that. Polls show the squad's harsh criticism of the Jewish state is out of step with voters, even in their own districts. The Democratic majority for Israel polled constituents for squad members Omar and Bush in December and January and found that just 6% of their voters support Hamas in the war. Okay, it's weird for anyone to support Hamas. You can support the Palestinian people, you could support the people of Gaza, you could support Israel. To support Hamas, pretty wacky compared to the more than 59% who back Israel. A December Pew poll found that 65% of Americans agree Hamas is more responsible for the war than Israel, although an Associated Press survey last month found that 50% of Americans say Israel's response has gone too far, up from 40% in November. I'll say. Those of us on the center left have to confront the extremes on the far left, Representative Torres told the Free Press. The Ceasefire Now movement is not a monolith. It contains the well-intentioned and ill-intentioned. The most nefarious members, though, are siding with Hamas. Those extreme elements should be categorically rejected. So I kind of wanted to talk about that, just the conversations that are going along, especially with this. It was just, I just thought it was like, at this point, the point that we are at in the Israel-Hamas war, to just have this much coverage and have it be a top story in so many news sources that, you know, whether or not sexual assault and rape occurred, again, like horrific parts of war, but just like all these people are dead. Is this really the top part of the story? I don't think so. It felt very weird and off to me. All right, guys, that is our show for today. Thank you so much for joining us on Without a Country. Again, if you want to email me, it's withoutacountrypodcast@gmail.com. Get your tickets to the Eye of the Tiger Tour 2024. You can go to tickets at CorinneFisher.com, or you can head over to the Linktree link in my bio. Also, tomorrow, if you're in New York City and you want to see Guys We Fucked the Experience live, this is our last show for a while. Again, this is going to be Thursday at 7 p.m. at the MasterCard Midnight Theater in New York City. Grab a ticket to that. It'll be so fun. Christina, me, and then this will be Eric Freddy, our new producer's first live appearance. You're definitely going to want to get a ticket to that. And Los Angeles, don't forget, we just announced that we are doing Netflix is a Joke Festival. We are doing a Guys We Fucked live podcast, which means the interview. There's going to be music from Joel Ronson, who, yes, is John Ronson's son. He's a really talented musician. I love his music. We featured it on the podcast. We're going to do an interview with an amazing guest, and that is going to be at the Regent Theater in Los Angeles on May 11th. Tickets are already on sale. It's a Saturday at 9:45 p.m. Please make sure you're following me on social media at Philanthropy Gal on Instagram, on X, a.k.a. Twitter. Those follows mean a lot to me. And you can follow Without a Country Podcast on Instagram, and also click the subscribe button for Without a Country Podcast on YouTube, whether or not that's how you consume the show. I appreciate you so much. Continue using critical thinking. Continue speaking out. Continue seeking the truth always, no matter what political party you're involved in. And make sure you're registered to vote, okay, before it's too late. I know you can feel like it doesn't count, but like, just do your due diligence. Like, this is part of the reason we live in America. Part of what's exciting about living in America, we have a say. So make sure you're part of that say. I'm Corinne Fisher. Have a great night. Bye.